Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 11th, 2014. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, the mechanics of flies' evasive maneuvers. And David Grimm is here with the latest stories from our daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Flies can be annoyingly good at evasive action. Take it from anyone trying to smack one down with a fly swatter. Such rapid avoidance requires these tiny flying daredevils to perceive and respond to a looming threat almost instantaneously. I spoke with Michael Dickinson about his team's efforts to capture these maneuvers on video and what the images revealed about the aerodynamics of fruit flies.
We used an array of high-speed video cameras, and they were operating at over 7,000 frames per second to capture the wing and body motion of flies as they evaded the looming image of an approaching predator. The speed with which flies can change direction is pretty remarkable. They alter course within about a hundredth of a second, which is nearly 30 times faster than we blink our eyes.
So let's start with your setup. How did you actually capture flies in the process of avoiding threats?
Yeah, it was a pretty complicated setup. For many years, biologists like myself have been using high-speed video cameras, which have really done to the time domain what the electron microscope did to the spatial domain. It allows us to see things happening on a very fast time scale. And in order to get the precise motion of the wing and body of the flies, we needed three of these cameras operating at 7,500 frames per second. And we needed to have a way of presenting a visual stimulus to the fly while at the same time being able to visualize the fly ourselves. And that actually is part of a problem, because normally when you do high-speed video, you have to use very, very bright lights because the shutter speed is effectively 1/30,000th of a second. But if we use bright lights, we would blind the flies and they couldn't see our stimulus. So we did all of our imaging in infrared so that we could see the flies, but the flies sort of didn't know, that they were being imaged. So we have three cameras arranged at right angles and a pair of laser beams right at the center of focus, so that when the flies went through the laser beams, we triggered the cameras to start capturing data. And at the same time, the flies are flying within a cylindrical electronic display of thousands of light-emitting diodes, and we could create the visual stimulus of this looming object that the fly sees and then would rapidly try to steer away from, presumably thinking it was either a predator or something that it was about to crash into.
And so how did you decide where the prey would loom from?
That's a great question, because one of the things we found is that the flies are very good at figuring out where the predator is coming from, and they maneuver accordingly. You know, we have the ability to have the predator come from any direction, but because in each experiment, we just put a bunch of flies in the chamber, and occasionally one would fly directly through the center of focus of the cameras, and, you know, its heading would be different every single time. So we just kept the stimulus coming from the same place, but because the flies had a different initial heading, we ended up with a lot of data. You know, sometimes the fly would experience looming in front, sometimes behind, sometimes from the side.
So they provided the variability there.
So they provided the variability, even though we had, you know, initially planned to use the electronic display. It just turned out not to be necessary.
So let's talk about some of these numbers here. It's a very, very high speed video camera capturing video of flies. How fast do the flies actually go, and how fast do their wings move up and down?
Yeah, well, first of all, I got a standard correction. It's unfortunate that everybody talks about the wings flapping up and down.
Okay.
And in fact, even biologists say upstroke and downstroke. But flies actually flap their wings forward and backwards.
Huh.
They make a stroke plane that's not unlike a helicopter. The wings flap back and forth more or less parallel to the ground in a horizontal plane. And they do so, the flies we used, which was a species of fruit fly, they flap their wings about 200 times a second. So the frame rate captured about 40 images of each wing stroke. So it's not so much that the flies themselves move rapidly. Mm-hmm. The high frame rate is primarily to be able to capture wing motion.
And some of these very, very tiny motions they do in order to make big changes in the way that they go.
That's right. One of the real surprises, not just in this research, but other research on insect flight over the last few years, is that the animals are generating these remarkable maneuvers with very, very tiny changes in wing motion. I mean, you might imagine, you know, for a fly to sort of, you know, pull a 360 and, you know, in 10 milliseconds that it would be generating these huge changes in wing motion, but that's actually not true. They're very, very subtle. And that's why so much effort, and I have to give credit to Florian Mures, who was the lead author on this paper, and a lot of effort went into building a system that could detect very small changes in wing motion accurately.
So let's actually back up for a second, back to basics, and talk about how exactly a fly flies.
Yeah, as I was mentioning earlier, you have to imagine a tiny wing that is sweeping forward through the air, and it does so at a very high angle of attack. So angle of attack is basically the sort of angle of the wing relative to the direction of motion. And aircraft, fixed aircraft, such as, you know, 747s, use angle of attacks that are very, very low, on the order of a few degrees, whereas flies and other insects use very high angles of attack, closer to 45 degrees. So they're really sweeping through the air. And then when they reach the end of the stroke, the wing rotates over. It flips over by about 90 degrees so that when it flaps back, it's also flapping back with an angle of attack of about 45 degrees. So it's able to generate upward lift during both the forward stroke and the backward stroke. And it turns out that these high angles of attack are really necessary for the mechanisms, the aerodynamic mechanisms that flies use, because the angle of attack is so high that flow around the leading edge of the wing, the front end of the wing, actually sort of detaches and forms this little tiny flow structure called a leading edge vortex, which is like a little tiny kind of tornado on its side lying along the wing. And it's the generation of this leading edge vortex that is able to create the high forces that flies need to stay in the air and maneuver.
So after all your analysis of these videos, what were you able to tell about what they did in response to one of these threats?
Probably the first thing that just sort of shouted from the data is that flies, although they've often been recently described as swimming in the air and turning as someone in a rowboat might steer by generating a little bit more drag on one side, the correct sort of nautical and aerodynamic term is yawing. So turning by just sort of rotating their whole body without tilting it to change direction. But in fact, what flies do is exactly what aircraft do when they're trying to generate a very fast maneuver. They roll and pitch the whole body, sometimes almost flying upside down so that the forces that they create are pointed in a new direction, pointed to the left or to the right or backwards. And that changes their direction of motion very, very quickly, just as a banked turn does in a helicopter or an airplane.
Very cool. So you make a point of using the word visually directed.
Yeah.
In the way you describe these turns in the title of your paper, is that an important part of your findings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, my lab and the people working on this project have half their foot in biomechanics and trying to understand how the animal can change its pattern of wing motion and change the aerodynamic forces to produce these rapid maneuvers. But, you know, we're also interested in the underlying neurobiology. So I was actually trained as a neuroscientist. And to me, the other aspect of this problem is how quickly visual information gets turned into a motor command. So I was describing how the animals do these evasive maneuvers by either rolling their bodies over or pitching their body up and down. But the actual amount of roll and pitch is determined by where the fly sees this looming stimulus. So it very quickly, its visual system tells its motor system where the threat is coming from, and it rotates in, you know, more or less exactly the right way in order to create a force that pulls it away from the looming threat. And this is all done, you know, very, very rapidly, very, very elegantly and robustly in an animal that has a brain the size of a, you know, salt grain.
Mm-hmm.
The fly has many, many specializations for performing these maneuvers very, very quickly, including one of the fastest visual systems on the planet and an elegantly designed motor system whereby little tiny changes in little tiny steering muscles can produce exactly the right alterations in wing motion to rotate the body in the correct fashion, depending upon where the threat is seen.
How does finding out this information about how a fly senses, processes information, and takes action on it, how does that apply to engineering or what we know about other animals or that kind of thing?
You know, if you think about the history of engineering, and mostly we, over the past 5,000 years, we usually think about big things like pyramids, you know, ocean liners, skyscrapers, and so forth. But a lot of the new challenges in engineering are all about small. They're all about building little tiny things, including, you know, small insect-sized autonomous robots and other devices. And we look around the world for good inspiration on how to build small things. I think there's really no better place than insects because they're the most successful radiation of life on the planet. What to me is really extraordinary is just how robust these behaviors are generated by this tiny, tiny, tiny brain. And I don't think figuring out how fly brains work is a sort of a warm-up problem to understanding how the human brain works. I think it's a really deep, challenging problem in and of itself because the fly is performing these behaviors with, you know, such a small, tiny brain and without the benefit of learning. When a fly, you know, emerges for the first time, it can perform these behaviors. I mean, imagine putting a baby in a cockpit, right? Or imagine pushing a newly hatched bird out of the nest. It would just crash to the ground. And we tend to think maybe because we're sort of obsessed with our own abilities that learning is the most sophisticated things that brains do. But being able to work perfectly without any training mm-hmm. is a very, very challenging task that these animals perform routinely. And boy, if we could figure out how to build, you know, little tiny microcomputers that had the same robustness of a fly brain, we'd be living in a different world.
Michael Dickinson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Sarah. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Dickinson and colleagues write about rapid banking turns in the fruit fly in this week's issue. You can read the paper and watch some of their flying fly videos at www.sciencemag.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the sounds of ancient violins. The idea that old violins, we're talking 300-year-old Stradivariuses here, are superior to modern instruments reigns in pop culture. But not everyone believes in the superiority of centuries-old wood and varnish. How could technology not have improved in all that time? So, Dave, what makes these old violins so special? What do people like about them?
Well, one of the most famous violin makers was a man named Antonio Stradivari, who lived in the mid-1600s to the early 1700s. And if you've heard of a Stradivarius, these are very well-known violins, hundreds of years old. One recently sold at auction for $45 million.
Wow.
So they're highly valued. A lot of musicians think they can only sort of reach the top of their game if they play a Stradivarius. But there's been some evidence over the last few years that modern violins may be just as good.
Right. So these old-fashioned violins, these old-time violins, have actually been put to a Pepsi Challenge type test. And this has happened in the past, and people have complained about the results. What have we seen so far up until this work?
What we've seen so far is that people have a really hard time telling the old ones from the new ones. But critics have complained that the sample sizes were too small, that there were biases introduced in the study. So in this new study, the researchers really wanted to eliminate as many of the biases as possible. They ran it double blind. So the players that they used didn't know what they were playing. They actually had to wear blindfold. The researchers didn't even know which violins they were giving the players. So they were trying to make it as objective as possible. And basically during a week in 2012, they invited 10 professional soloists to Paris to play either Stradivariuses or much more modern violins, and to see whether the players could recognize the difference, whether those who listened could recognize the difference as well.
There was a distinct preference for violins, but which one was it?
People preferred the new violins.
So everyone can save a lot of money now?
That's right. If you take the study to heart, that really means that not only is it not worth spending $45 million on a Stradivarius, but that you may actually get a better sound from a newer violin. Now, the critics are not on board yet. They say that the study was, again, too small, that the players really didn't have enough time with these violins to really get into the nuances of what makes a Stradivarius a Stradivarius. I think there are some people that will just never be convinced by these results.
Next up, we have a story on the origin of plate tectonics. Compared to the other planets in our solar system, Earth has a lot of oddities: liquid water, friendly atmosphere. But of these, the least talked about has to be plate tectonics, the presence of massive plates of rock on the surface of the planet. And these plates are responsible for volcanoes, earthquakes, and mountains. Other planets just don't have them. And why the Earth does has been a matter for debate. The other question is how they actually arose in the first place. So, Dave, what are some competing ideas about the origins of tectonic plates?
Well, some studies have suggested they arose about 4 billion years ago, but others say it was much more recent, or at least much more recent, geologically speaking, about 2.7 billion to 3 billion years ago. And that's a really big gap. Earth is only 4.5 billion years old, so 1 billion years is actually a lot of time in our planet's history.
So the question is somewhat about how to reconcile these two dates. There's evidence that these plates arose 4 billion years ago, and other evidence suggests, you know, that it's 3 billion years. What are some of the theories for this discrepancy?
One idea was that it was just a very, very slow process, and you didn't just all of a sudden have the appearance of plate tectonics. It developed over hundreds of millions of years, which is why you'd come up with both of those dates. And this has just been a really difficult question to answer because plate tectonics really gives the planet a facelift. And you can imagine if you keep on giving the planet a facelift, it's really hard to determine what it looked like originally.
Right. So old evidence gets buried under the newest plate.
Exactly. To figure that out, the researchers looked at lithospheric rocks, and the lithosphere is Earth's rigid outer shell. And they wanted to see what happened to the lithosphere under very intense pressure and deformation, which is what you would see during the evolution of plate tectonics. And what they found is that these weak spots that form the boundaries between the plates really took a long time to form. So it does add evidence to the idea that this was a very slow, gradual process.
This explanation could address the timing issue. You know, we had maybe one way back 4 billion years ago, and then many more arose over the next couple billion years. What about the lack of tectonic plates on other planets? Does this address that?
Well, that's the really interesting thing about plate tectonics. We don't see it anywhere else in the solar system, not on any other planets, not in any other moon. So there must be something unique about Earth that we have that. And Earth's twin planet, sometimes it's called Venus, doesn't have plate tectonics. It's also a lot hotter than Earth is. And so one suggestion from the researchers is that just conditions aren't right. It's too hot. With these extreme temperatures, the boundaries between the plates would never form, and therefore you would never have the development of plate tectonics. So it's some really interesting insight, not only to when plate tectonics started on our planet, but why it's so unique to our planet in the first place.
Finally, we have a story on death by amoeba. Now, when I hear the phrase death by amoeba, I immediately jump to phagocytosis. Maybe not everyone goes there, but mainly these types of cells, these single-celled organisms, do eat by surrounding their prey on all sides and bringing the whole whatever it is right into their cell in one gulp. But it turns out one kind of amoeba that causes health problems in humans might have a different eating style. So, Dave, what specific amoeba are we talking about here?
This is an amoeba, Sarah, called Entamoeba histolytica, and it's responsible for a disease known as amoebiasis, which infects 50 million people and kills 100,000 people a year, mostly in developing countries. It's spread through food and water. And what scientists do know is that it attacks the gut and causes potentially fatal diarrhea, ulcers, and liver abscesses.
And it's kind of unpredictable. You can live with it. It can cohabitate with all the bacteria in your gut, or it can start taking a bite out of you. And for about 100 years, everyone assumed that these guys were doing one thing, and in comes some new technology, and now we know different.
That's right. What scientists thought was happening is that the amoeba were just simply killing our intestinal cells and other cells in the body. They would make contact with them, somehow kill them and then eat them after they kill them. What this new study suggests, which is based on some pretty cool fluorescent microscopy, and there's actually a video of this you can see on the site, is that the amoeba start eating the cells while they're still alive. They're basically kind of like sharks. They go in and they just start nibbling pieces off of the cells in our body until the cells are dead.
So instead of taking in the dead cell, the amoeba actually kill them by biting them. What exactly does biting mean in this context?
Well, cells obviously don't have teeth, so they're not exactly sure how this process happens. It probably involves just nipping pieces of cells in our body, nipping them piece by piece. And when you look at the video on the site, you'll see a human cell that's fluorescently labeled, and you'll see little pieces of fluorescence being ingested by the amoeba. So it's pretty gruesome as far as a microbial feeding frenzy goes.
Does seeing this on camera actually open up new pathways to curing this disease?
Well, the researchers actually tested a drug that prevented the amoeba from nibbling, and the drug seemed to have an effect. So it does open up avenues for potentially treating this disease. It turns out if you want to treat the disease, you may just have to stop these guys from eating cells alive.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about an ancient bee unearthed from a tar pit and what it's telling us about ancient ecology. Also a story about a new mobile app that has been developed to fight jet lag. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got the latest on the controversy swirling around some stem cell studies coming out of Japan, and another story about how the pro-life movement is causing a lot of worry among EU scientists. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.